keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shootings, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
And many of us boomers remember that last voice there. That was Lyndon Johnson. We were at Woodstock. Now every day, more than 10,000 American boomers turn 65. And it's going to involve cultural, economic, and political change just ahead. Our country is not prepared. But my guest today says the changes may signal a major, very positive shift in how all of us think about community. Ai-Jen Poo has a new book. She is our guest. The book is called The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elderly Future in a Changing America. Gloria Steinem, a vanguard, of course, of the aging boomer generation, says every American should read this slender book. With luck, it will be the future for all of us. Thank you very much for being with us, Ai-Jen Poo.
Hi.
Well,
great to be with you.
Well, thank you. And for people who aren't familiar with who you are, Ai-Jen Poo was named a MacArthur Genius and was named one of Newsweek's 150 Fearless Women and one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of the World. She spearheaded New York's successful Bill of Rights for Domestic Workers. Thank you for doing that. In this book, she shows how we can better care for our growing elderly population and provide millions of good jobs at the same time. Some have suggested that her book, The Age of Dignity, may become a touchstone of a new social movement around aging. Well, again, thanks for being with us. What stimulated you to write this book? You've been working in other areas. What was the purpose in your putting this book out?
Well, I've spent the last 20 years working alongside domestic workers who are going to work in other people's homes, caring for their children and their aging loved ones, also doing cleaning as housekeepers. And I've just witnessed the incredible care and commitment they bring to their work, despite the fact that it's really undervalued by our society and they're among the most vulnerable and lowest paid workers in our society today.
Right.
And at the same time that we've been working to address those issues, we noticed that more and more domestic workers were starting to do elder care because there's this incredible increase in the need for care, long-term care, particularly in the home, because most people don't want to go to a nursing home anymore.
Right.
And so a lot of our workers were asking for training, and we realized that there is no infrastructure or support for the growing caregiving needs of our aging population in this country. And as a result, home care is the fastest growing occupation in the country, and yet it is still poverty wage work that is not really valued or recognized. So we kind of saw it as a moment of opportunity to bring broad cross-sections of our American public together to say we need solutions that work for all of us.
And I think about the foundation of capitalism, supply and demand. There is a fast-growing supply or demand, I should say, a supply of us older folks and a huge demand coming up. Won't that simple you know, law of capitalism take care of the problem, I suppose it would mean that, you know, with the growing demand, the supply of good workers, it will drive the wages down. And what does that mean? And what might be the effects of that on quality elderly care and the people who provide it?
Well, I actually don't know. I'm not an economist, but I will say that we will, by the year 2050, we will have 27 million of us in this country who will need some form of care or assistance just to meet our basic daily needs, 27 million. Right. And today, there is a direct care workforce. That's including everyone, nursing home workers, home care workers, home attendants, personal care aides, everyone is only 3 million workers. And there are incredibly high turnover rates because people can't sustain, they can't make ends meet doing this work, mm-hmm. they can't support their families. And there are really high rates of burnout because not only are people working hard and living in poverty, but they're isolated, it's hard work, there's no training, there's no support. And so if we are going to actually meet the needs of the 27 million, we're going to need a whole new approach to the workforce and really ultimately to the whole way in which we think about and value caregiving.
Yeah, interesting. As you said, you've worked with organizing domestic workers who, you know, up until recently have been kind of invisible. No, you know, they haven't gotten a lot of attention, and yet their work is, people depend on them to do good work, and they've been, you know, their, as you said, their wages and living conditions have not been great. So that's, is that currently the case for a lot of home care workers?
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's so many parallels because it's a similar dynamic where you're working in isolation, you're in someone else's home, you are earning poverty wages, there's very little training or preparation, and you have very little control over your time or your hours. And oftentimes, the people that you're caring for have very different needs, and sometimes if you're caring for somebody with dementia or Alzheimer's, it can be very grueling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's tremendous similarity, and in fact, it's really one sector of care providers who have been sort of made invisible by our economy. And ultimately, what we're trying to do is say, let's actually bring all of this work out of the shadows, whether it's home care or domestic work. Let's bring it out of the shadows into the full light of our economy so that we can improve the quality of care, improve the quality of jobs, establish standards, create subsidies for families, have a real comprehensive and proactive approach that anticipates the scale of what's to come.
And that's there's a lot on the plate there, and I hope to discuss that throughout the next number of minutes. On Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Ai-Jen Poo, who's got a new book out called The Age of Dignity. I wonder if you could describe the elder boom. I mean, I was part of the baby boom, born in 1950, right at the epicenter of the baby boom. Haven't hit 65 quite yet, but really close. And I'm certainly looking I'm looking very much forward to Medicare, I'll tell you. I wonder if you could describe the elder boom America is about to experience. What percentage of people are over the age of 65 today? What percentage will be by the year 2030, which is coming up real quick? And what percentage of elders will need some kind of support to live comfortably?
Well, we have about 11 million people who are over the age of 65, and by 11% of our population is over the age of 65, and by the year 2030, 20% of our population, so it's almost double, 20% of our population will be over the age of 65, and that is a direct result. The reason why I call it the elder boom is because it is a direct result of the baby boom generation starting to reach retirement age, at a rate of 10,000 people per day, 4 million people per year. And it's also a reflection of the fact that we've made tremendous advances in healthcare and technology and medicine. And so people are living longer than ever before, actually 20 years longer than the average life expectancy in the year 1930. So we have my grandmother's generation of 85 and older is now the fastest growing demographic in the country because of our extended longevity. So that explains what some call the silver tsunami.
Yeah.
I call the elder boom. I think it's actually a tremendous opportunity if we put the right supports in place.
We always like to discuss opportunities here on Keeping Democracy Alive. And, you know, the vast majority of Americans feel uneasy about placing our parents in institutions, nursing homes, as, you know, not the best place for elders to spend their final days. You've been on the inside of the caregiving establishment and seen the often hidden lives of seniors and their caregivers. So your aversion, aside from just the fear that most of us have about, you know, nursing homes, elderly centers, comes from personal experience. Tell us about your own personal experience on this, please.
Sure. Well, my grandfather, who played a big role in raising me, I had the great fortune of having my grandparents live with me when I was young. After they retired, they moved in with us, and throughout my childhood, even before they retired, I spent summers with them and spent as much time as I could with them. And my parents really emphasized that. And so I was very close to my grandfather on my father's side, who was a Tai Chi instructor and actually an Air Force engineer in Taiwan for a long time. And he, in the last years of his life, he lived a very long life, to his early 90s, and there came a point when his health deteriorated to an extent that my father couldn't find appropriate home care support for him and ended up placing him in a nursing home against his wishes. And so he spent the last 3 months of his life in a nursing home, and my visits to him there were incredibly haunting. And I still live with regret that moment that we couldn't actually keep him home. Because what I saw when I was there was an institution where people were living six, seven people in a room. Oftentimes the basic utilities weren't working in the room. People were left there and unattended to for long, long periods of time. My grandfather actually didn't eat or sleep for days on end, because he was just unable to adapt to that environment, to the food, to the both the noises and the smells, and frankly, just the lack of a human connection there. Mm-hmm. And so I that image and the sounds and the smells and feeling my grandfather's fear living in that place is something that stays with me. And to be clear, I know that there are many nursing homes where the atmosphere is much more like a home environment, and it's very caring, and certainly the staff makes every attempt to be caring. But I think the institutional model is one that has a lot of problems with it, and many people have had the experience that my grandfather had in an institution.
Yes, I think a lot of us have seen that and have, you know, haunting memories of the institutional aspects of it. And it's been unclear, you know, what else can we do? You know, in past generations, it seems that in general, people used to age at home with family members taking care of them. Why does that model not work anymore? Could it work? Should it work?
It actually is working in a lot of places. A lot of states have done what they call rebalancing, which is for Medicaid. In the Medicaid program, people are able to access home and community-based care and services. as an alternative to nursing homes in some states. And in those states, it's a really much preferred option as far as I can tell. My grandmother is supported by a home care worker in California named Mrs. Sun, and she's 89 years old and still living in her own apartment, living life on her own terms. She eats when she wants. She walks when she wants. She goes to church when she wants. She even sings in the church choir. She plays mahjong when she wants. She's living life on her own terms, and that's largely due to the fact that we count on a caregiver named Mrs. Sun who can provide support to my grandmother in ways as she needs more of it over time, in ways that allow her to live with dignity and still independently.
And but it sounds like you are exceptionally lucky to have a Mrs. Sun.
That's right.
Why doesn't every elder have the opportunity to have a Mrs. Sun? And, you know, it must, I assume, have something to do with affordability and being able to pay for it.
It's such a funny thing, because the truth of it is my family did not have a plan around our caregiving for my grandparents. And that lack of a plan resulted in my grandfather spending the last 3 months of his life in that nursing home facility. And we just got lucky when it came to Mrs. Sun, frankly. And the reason why is because we as a country don't have a plan. A lot of people don't realize that Medicare does not pay for home care or long-term care at all. And so if you're very, very poor, you could be eligible for Medicaid, Medicaid-supported care. And if you're very wealthy, you could purchase long-term care insurance. But I've heard from so many people that even long-term care insurance doesn't always cover what you need when you need it. And so the vast majority of Americans are stuck in this bind of not having planned themselves, and in a country, living in a country where there's no plan for the caregiving needs of older adults and people with disabilities. And so basically people are going tapping their savings and spending down their retirement and borrowing money and giving up their homes. I mean, it's a struggle to afford it, absolutely. And I don't think that the reason why we don't have a program is because the country can't afford it. I think it's actually, the reality is that people, families are spending so much on care already, the cost of it is absolutely outrageous.
Yes.
The average nursing home stay, a private room in a nursing home, costs $87,000 a year.
Oh my! Wow.
There's no way that 27 million of us are going to be able to pay that, and certainly there aren't the facilities to support it. So I think that we are in a situation where we can no longer afford to not have a plan as a country. And therein lies the opportunity for us to actually come together and figure out a plan and a way forward that actually addresses both what families and seniors need and also what the workforce needs.
Wow, you certainly sent a shockwave through me as I'm approaching my elderly years, and I'm imagining all the listeners. $87,000 for a private room? That's just... It's stunning. And, you know, these institutions have been around a long time. The elderly centers have been pretty profitable in recent decades. It seems to me, my guess would be that with the knowledge of the coming retirements by us baby boomers, these institutions are probably going to be popping up all over the place. And I wonder about the future of this segment of elderly care and how much political power they may have, these, you know, private institutions. I wonder, I mean, you're talking about something different from that, an alternative from that, but I wonder if you could talk about a little bit about the political power of the money behind these elderly centers, many of whom are nice, quality places. Not all of them are, but what's your sense about the political power?
Well, I do know that the nursing home lobby is definitely very powerful and influential. And they are looking towards being able to expand with the coming elder boom. And I think they're also somewhat nervous about the fact that 90% of Americans would prefer to age in place at home, connected to their communities. So I think they're both working hard to defend their interests and you know, very concerned that the direction of the country is actually moving towards home care.
Interesting. And I have friends, good friends, who have shown remarkable devotion to taking care of their elderly parents. And I know what I see. They don't get paid for their work, taking care of their mother or father. What are some of the perhaps not quantifiable costs to family members who care for elders?
It's a great question. 73% of all of our caregiving is actually done by family members.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Family members are carrying an enormous weight when it comes to caregiving. And that's why all of our solutions really bear in mind that family caregivers need support, they need training and education, they need a lot of resources. Because really, when we think about the 27 million of us who are going to need care, it's kind of an all-hands-on-deck situation. Mm. I mean, it's going to require families to step up. It's going to require our public policy and our elected officials to step up. It's going to require community-based solutions where neighbors help neighbors. And I think all of that means that we're just going to have a much more caring society, a caring framework for how we relate to each other. And that's a good thing, I think.
I think so, too. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Ai-Jen Poo, whose new book is called The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elderly Future in a Changing America. And when you talk about caring, I can just imagine right-wingers, not conservative at all, just plain right-wingers who own the Republican Party these days, saying, caring, ew, we don't want to do that. We want people to be on their own. You know, this is rugged individualism here. And, you know, we know what that yields. And but then again, you know, there are family members. There's an awful lot of it. I wonder, you know, what you talk about, sense of community, sharing, caring, things like that, that, you know, the right wing would turn their noses up at. What alternative care models are there out there now? Tell us about some aging in place and community care pilot programs that you've found out about.
You know, there's so much. I mean, this is the thing, is that this is why I'm so optimistic and why the book is actually an incredibly hopeful book.
We like that.
Because people are amazing. I mean, people come up with amazing ways to support each other. And there's incredible initiative and innovation happening at the community level. So what started as a group of friends in Boston coming together, deciding that they wanted to live together as they aged, has now become a movement called the Village Movement, where there are over 100, actually probably up to 200 villages all over the country, which are intentional communities that seniors have built together, where they pool resources and actually do things together. And it reduces the costs of things like transportation and caregiving services and groceries. But they're essentially living in a community that is about sharing and caring for one another. There are naturally occurring retirement communities where communities have pulled together in similar ways to develop or create the kind of supports that they need, like social workers and care managers and also caregivers. And there are there in Japan, there's this wonderful program called the Caring Relationship Tickets, which is basically a time banking program where you can go and take care of your neighbor for a couple hours, maybe go buy groceries and make food for them for a few hours, and then you bank that time, and somebody who lives near your mother on the other side of the country would then actually, you could cash those hours in so that a neighbor of your mother could go and take care of her, or you could even cash those hours in for yourself later if you needed care. And programs like that have actually saved the Japanese government billions of dollars in their healthcare system. So some of these are actually at scale in other countries. In the U.S., they're starting to scale, but they're certainly having an impact.
That's fascinating. I wonder how, there's a lot to discuss from what you just said, how it got started in Japan. Was it a government initiative, or did it come from more democratically from the grassroots up?
You know, it's a good question about its history. My sense is that the initiative came from the grassroots, mm-hmm. and then it became government supported as it started to scale,
mm-hmm.
As the government realized that it's definitely in its interest to support this program of neighbors helping neighbors.
And, you know, you think about healthcare, and you mentioned that, you know, just electrifying figure of $87,000 per year for a private room. That's rather expensive. And with so many of us coming into the, retirement years, it's, you know, and I definitely want to get back to the community alternatives, the expense that there is now. And, you know, you look at how much it costs now. I wonder if what better solutions would not be exceedingly expensive, enormously expensive, you know, to have these policy changes. How, you know, talk to some of those expenses. I mean, not right now, nobody's really prepared for it. Nobody's really thought about it, since Social Security was enacted in 1935. Not many people lived past 65, as you mentioned, and now we're living like 20 years longer than that. So we're not prepared, and there's this big, huge question mark with a lot of dollars attached. I wonder if you could talk about how much it may be costing. I don't know if it's a way to measure the gross domestic expense for elderly care as it is now, and if it'd be more expensive what you're talking about or less.
Well, I think that there's a lot of research that shows that home care is much more cost effective than institution-based care, when you think about $87,000 a year, it's way more than a living wage salary for a home care provider. So
good point.
There's a lot of ways in which it's more cost effective for the families to do home care. I also think that when you have personalized and person-centered care, which is much more likely to happen in a home and community-based environment, you also save the healthcare system a lot of money, because a lot of the expenses in our healthcare system come from the conditions that are a direct result of aging bodies and our inability to manage well chronic illnesses that come from growing older, or things like dementia, Alzheimer's care, incredible expense to our healthcare system. And if home care workers, this workforce that we've so undervalued, if they're really on the front lines every day of what their clients need, they know what they're eating, whether they're taking medication, how much they're sleeping. I mean, these are all critical factors in someone's ability to stay healthy and live well. In some ways, what we always say is, caregiving is the best prevention, right? There's all this talk about preventative health care. And really, somebody who's really tuned into your needs and your well-being is really the best prevention. And that is especially the case when it comes to older adults. And so we believe that even though a front-end investment in home care and creating a social program, a social insurance policy program, or tax credits or a subsidy for people who are paying for home care or long-term care, even though the front end of it will be an investment in public dollars and maybe even our own dollars. I mean, public dollars are our own dollars, but I mean, in addition right. to families paying in, that it will ultimately save all of us a tremendous amount of financial costs, but also emotional costs.
Interesting. It's nice when the prospective solutions are not only better and more humane than what we have now, but that they also save money.
Save money. Yes. It's a That's always convenient.
Yeah, it's a great combination. Well, and you mentioned some of what Japan has done. I understand Germany has also enacted some policies as well that are rather innovative.
Germany and Japan both have social insurance programs that cover long-term care comprehensively.
Oh, wow.
So it's as if Medicare covered home care and long-term care needs comprehensively.
Ah.
It's a part of their health care program.
That's so obvious that...
Yes, exactly.
But, I wonder, is there any talk of that now in our wonderful Congress down in Washington, D.C., as a way to save money? Are there any people who are taking the lead on that?
You know, there are a lot of questions about whether it makes sense to create it as part of Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I think a lot of debate in Washington about what is the right solution. I think there's beginning to be more of an acknowledgement that the fact that there's no real support for long-term care is a major problem. That needs to be addressed, and it's going to be long-term care is going to be one of the main themes of this year's White House Conference on Aging.
Oh, interesting.
Which only happens once every 10 years. But I think there's no agreement on the way forward on the actual policy vehicles that could address these issues. And so part of what my book is trying to do and what Caring Across Generations, our movement is trying to do, is actually create a lot more public debate and discussion about this so that more of us, in the spirit of your show, can democratically participate in shaping the solutions for the future.
What a concept, keeping democracy alive and democratically, you know, solutions coming from the people themselves and not being dictated to us from you know, the top down, but actually coming from the bottom up. You talked about I wonder if you could indulge me here. What would you like to see? I don't know if you have a specific set of solutions. You know, painting a good picture for a better solution for what we have now. I mean, many of us wanted to simply expand Medicare as a solution to the health care insurance-created crisis that there is. And obviously, we haven't gotten simply expanding Medicare. I mean, it seems so logical. But I wonder what, you know, if you were, say, in a cabinet position, able to have the ear of both the president and Congress, you know, if you could dictate, shall we say, solutions, what would you like to see put out there?
I have three policy goals that I think should shape our solutions. One is about affordability of quality care, that there should not only be high-quality care for everyone, but that it should be affordable. The second goal is around choices. I really think that there's no one solution. There's definitely no one-size-fits-all here.
Right.
There will be some people for whom nursing home is the only option that makes sense, and there will be people who will absolutely not want to go to a nursing home and will want to be at home.
Sure.
And everything in between, assisted living, there's all kinds of scenarios in between, and I think that families should have that choice. And the situations are so varied that it's almost essential that they do have real choices. So choice is the second goal. The third goal is about quality jobs. Uh-huh. We have to know and appreciate that this, our ability to care for our loved ones is going to have to depend on a really strong, secure workforce that is a professional workforce that doesn't have to work in the shadows, that can receive training and support and find themselves on a career pathway and be recognized and valued as the true first responders and incredibly important workers that they are in our economy. So quality jobs, maximum choice, and affordable quality care. That would be my framework for how we develop solutions.
And Ai-Jen Poo, you talked about values a little bit there. You know, that's really what we are talking about. And you know, we have policymakers, like it or not, there are people that we, the people, elect, and they get a lot of pressure from, you know, big money interests right now. And the truth is they're also affected by, very much so, by grassroots, and they need to hear from us. And you talk about values and communicating those values through what's left of the democratic system. It obviously, it can and does work. People forget about that. We are not powerless. And there are a lot of, you mentioned choices that can serve us best. The biggest, well, one of the biggest seems to be, you know, when it comes to long-term care. There are those insurance policies that people can buy. It's very confusing. And there's also the possibility, as you say, of buying in bulk, having the government do this and have a policy, you know, like single payer would save a great deal of money. It's rather difficult to get to. I do believe we will get there eventually. But having the government as perhaps purchasing agent, it just seems to me, makes a lot of sense. And as I mentioned that, you know, we are not powerless. We are not simply subject to the whims of, say, the insurance industry and the nursing home providers, who are not all bad people. They're not all bad interests, for sure. But there's an example of effective change-making, which is as a result of your organizing and that of many others. For the first time since the New Deal starting January 2015, home care providers have minimum wage and overtime protections. How did that enormous victory come about? People need to be encouraged on things like this.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, domestic workers have been working to pass protections to address some of these New Deal exclusions for way over a decade now. It's been probably almost 15 years. And our first success was in New York, where we passed the first domestic workers' Bill of Rights. And then domestic workers in other states started organizing and advocating for legislation. And so we've now passed legislation in Massachusetts, Hawaii, California, and we're currently working in Connecticut and Illinois. And as that was happening, it was really driven by the workers, telling their stories, mm-hmm. engaging directly with legislators about what their reality was, about the value of their work, really forcing legislators and the general public, allied organizations, all kinds of people of all walks of life to really think about the value and the dignity of this work and the injustice of the exclusions over time. And as we were doing that work, we realized that there was an opportunity to work in partnership with the Department of Labor to address this one loophole that has kept 2 million home care workers from receiving basic minimum wage protections. And that's this loophole called the companionship exemption. The Department of Labor wanted to update the definition of companionship so that workers who are doing caregiving work as their profession could actually be protected like all other workers as opposed to discriminated against through this companionship loophole. And so we worked to address that, worked very hard, and advocates have been working on this since the Clinton administration. And this year, on January 1st, it was supposed to go into effect, but we have been hindered by a court case. And so we are still planning on moving ahead, but there is some litigation that is pending that it has thrown a little delay in things.
Well, nothing worth having comes without a lot of difficulty, it seems.
Exactly.
And we talk about, what is in place now. The Older Americans Act turns 50 years old this year, passed as part of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society reforms. It was to include home and community-based support for elders. That act is still in effect. How has that fared over time? Has it adequately achieved its intended goals? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think it is still a work in progress. It's done a lot of good. It established area agencies on aging and created other resources, important resources in the community. But I think the reality is that to support home and community-based care and services and really ultimately dignified quality of life for older Americans, there needs to be real resources invested in it programmatically, and I think that the Older Americans Act has been underfunded, frankly, and is really just the beginning of what's needed. It's a great starting point, and if we were to resource it, all of its programs fully, it would be a great step forward. But ultimately, I think what my book is saying is that it's just the beginning of what's needed, and we have to be much bolder and much more proactive and willing to invest, understanding that the outcomes or the return on investment will not only be in terms of cost and financial savings and efficiency, but also in terms of the soul of the country.
The soul of the country. And it does seem that, with this massive change in demographics, this huge bubble of us aging boomers, we'll kind of have to rethink a lot of things, how we live, work, organize our family and community lives.
That's right.
And this, of necessity, will involve a lot of change, cultural, economic, and political change, and how we think about our responsibilities to one another. I know a lot of people on the right feel we have no responsibility whatsoever, and it's going to affect how we feel about aging. Is this an overwhelming problem, or is it also a grand opportunity to address the overall lack of sense of community most Americans feel? That's a cultural change. Is this an opportunity to change the idea of community as opposed to rugged individualism, which was never reality? It was always just a myth from the 19th century. What do you think, Ijen?
I do think it's an opportunity to recognize how we're already so interdependent as a society and as a nation. I mean, even just thinking about the fact that oftentimes immigrants are called illegal aliens, or referred to as if there's some very strange alien thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
But really, a vast number of American families count on an undocumented immigrant caregiver to take care of their mother with Alzheimer's or their baby. I mean, it is like, I cannot imagine a more interdependent reality than the relationship between caregiver and family. And yet, there is this discourse around foreigners and aliens that is so far removed from what's actually happening. And I'm hopeful that what this moment presents is an opportunity for us to actually uncover and really reveal the authentic relationships that connect us all, and ultimately that allow for individuals to succeed. I do believe in individuals' identity and potential and all of that. And I think that what makes that possible is a web of human relationships, many of which are these caregiving relationships that have been made so invisible.
Yeah, and certainly elderly people, many of them still very much want to be creative and live life fully. And you talk about the fact that, you know, the immigration issue is interconnected with this. It does seem that there are, as you mentioned, a lot of the caregivers for elderly, as well as domestic workers that you have a lot of history with, are immigrants and, you know, not aliens of some sort. I wonder if there might be, if the solutions to both issues may be tied in together.
Absolutely. Immigrants are going to be a huge part of the solution to the 27 million question we have about ahead of us. Immigrants right now are between 20 and 30% of our caregiving workforce. And I think that both undocumented immigrants who are here currently doing this work, those who will do this work, and those who will come in the future to do this work are going to be a necessary part of the solution to our caregiving needs of the future. And I think that's a good thing. Oftentimes, immigrants bring with them different cultural norms and values around intergenerational relationships, honoring elders, really honoring and upholding our elders as social heroes. And I think that all of those values can really help to strengthen the social fabric of our country, not to mention improve the quality of care that people are receiving. And I certainly want that for my grandmother. I don't know about you.
Oh, yeah.
I certainly want somebody who really believes in caregiving and who honors elders to take care of our elders.
That is such a good point, I think, that so many cultures which really do not just give lip service, but really do honor elders and give them, you know, the respect that seems quite logical. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Ai-Jen Poo. Her new book is The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elderly Future in a Changing America. I want to run an idea by you that I had back in the optimistic late 60s. And that was, you know, you think about there's a lot of need. Young working parents who are trying to make it by, they have young kids. They have a real need for quality daycare. Not all daycare is quality right now, and it's not always affordable. At the same time, many older people have, guess what? Great skills when it comes to young children. You know, I've long thought that some programmatic linking up between, you know, young kids, toddlers, etc., even babies, and elderly people, that some linking up makes obvious sense, like daycares for elderly and very young kids. Any discussion about this?
That's actually a great point. There's this organization called Encore.org, which helps older adults find second and third careers, and really honors older adults in terms of their accomplishments late in life. And and one of the things that they're saying is that more and more grandparents are getting engaged in family care, but more and more elders are providing care in general for other elders, for people with disabilities, for children. And I think that that's a wonderful thing. And especially when it comes to children, that multi-generational connection, I certainly grew up with it and know how much it enriched my life and made me who I am today. And I think that that is, if we can encourage and support the kind of interaction that allows for children, young people, to be to grow and learn from older people of different generations, I think that that's a wonderful thing and should be encouraged.
Well, I certainly treasure the memories of loving grandparents. There's just something unique about that, and it's a wonderful thing to have in one's life. Other examples from popular culture, maybe, you know, my generation, a lot of us were so-called hippies, and we very much value feeling part of a community, having a sense of community. Is there, do you see signals of a change in attitude regarding we're all in it together, the need for community in our lives, reasons for optimism along those lines?
Absolutely. I think a lot of what's happening, even that technology is enabling, is really about building community in the 21st century. So whether it's the naturally occurring retirement communities or the village movements that seniors are building locally, or it's the online communities that are growing, the bloggers who have followings of, you know, 20, 30,000 people who all they write about is caregiving. I mean, this is people reaching out, trying to find community and connection around their experiences. Mm-hmm. And technology enables that. And it's a whole thing they call the sharing economy online, but a way in which people are sharing resources, sharing material things, like drills and neighborhoods, you know, but also connecting around ride shares and bike shares. And sure. I think it's people are looking for different ways of connecting to one another, both to meet their needs, their real practical needs in life, but also to create or reinvent what it means to have community in the 21st century. And so I see signs of that everywhere. I don't know what it's like in New Hampshire, but certainly everywhere here in urban environments, people are looking for new ways of finding community.
Yeah, I really think we absolutely, really, really want community. And I wonder about my generation. You know, we grew up with the unique blessings of post-war policies, which included a logical expectation that our government would serve us, that they were there to serve us. I wonder, is my generation different or the same in terms of what we expect from our so-called golden years?
Well, you know, I will say that I think if ever there was a generation that could change our social norms and values around aging, it is the baby boom generation.
That's
it is
us.
The generation that brought us rock and roll.
Yes.
That will change how we think and feel about aging. That's one of the reasons why I'm so optimistic, is because I think that boomers will only age on their own terms and will put into place what they need in order to do that. And so it's a hopeful thing for me. But I do think it will be an uphill battle because in this moment, we are in a moment where scarcity is the overwhelming feeling around politics and policy and budgets, and this notion that we are the wealthiest nation in the world, abundant in creativity and innovation, somehow gets lost when we start to think about policy solutions that are about meeting our needs. And so if the boomers can do anything, I think it's to create the moral and political will to dig in and really start addressing the needs of older adults, such that we can all age well with real choices.
Always appreciate optimism on this show, and it sounds very hopeful indeed. The book is called The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elderly Future in a Changing America. Our guest today is the author, Ai-Jen Poo, Ai-JenPoo, and fascinating book, fascinating subject, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we are talking largely about my generation, and I'm going to play something here by a group called the Zimmers, which is a whole bunch, 50 or so, of rather elderly people having a good time together.
First time I've done this, by the way.
People try to put us down. Because we get around
talking about our generation.
Things they do look awful cold.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I'll die before I get old.
Talking about my generation, baby.
Why don't you all fade away?
Talking about my generation.
Don't try to dig what we all just say.
Talking about my generation.
I'm not trying to cause a big sensation.
Talking about my generation.
I'm just talking about my generation.
Talking about my
before I get old.